Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have, as always, lots of emails. A lot of you, very nice, wrote in to say how happy you were that we were back. Got one tip, Gabe, for you and me. Don't know if you saw this. It was after we had talked so negatively about our personal experiences at the Frankfurt Airport international baggage claim. A tip from one of our longtime listeners saying, you know what, instead of going to Frankfurt, you should go to Munich, because Munich is number 9 on the Skytrax worldwide airport ranking.
Uh-huh.
Not really possible unless you're doing a strange trip to fly into Munich, but nice to keep in mind. Yeah, that's cleaner.
It's probably better than the entry at Frankfurt.
Yeah.
We went into that last week. This is from Brent, right? Brent also wrote in with a couple of studies looking into the psychology of home, because that's another topic that we delved into. I maybe even literally said that I don't feel home at home here. I don't know where home is. We will look into that, Brent. I think that topic is great. And if I were a singer-songwriter, I probably would write a song about it. But I'm not. So.
Didn't Simon Garfunkel? Now that you're saying
They already did, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess that song's been written. Moving now from Munich to home to Cologne. Gabe, you might remember Sammy or Jenny was writing on both their behalf that they're going on a Rhine River cruise.
Yeah.
And they asked for our advice for Cologne, Germany. What should they do and see and, more importantly, drink?
Yeah. Kölsch.
Kölsch.
The Cologne kind of beer.
Yeah.
You get it in a little tiny glass. It's like a long shot glass, a test tube.
Yeah.
And you can suck it down in one little gulp.
Or a couple gulps. Yeah, it depends what you're doing that night. But, Jenny, thank you for your follow-up email, because after we sent emails back and forth giving tips and advice, they went on that cruise, bunch of pictures in that Google Dropbox that I looked through. Looked beautiful. They went to Pefkin.
The Brauhaus, the brewery that you
The brewery
told
in Cologne. About. They also went to the Belgian Quarter that you, I believe, recommended, Gabe, and it just looked like a beautiful time, despite Sammy developing COVID on that trip.
Ah.
Yeah. A trip that began in Basel, Switzerland, and ended in Amsterdam. Looked great. Thanks for the follow-up email. And finally, we talked about balancing and grip strength as you age. A final email here from one of our listeners who says, if you want to improve your balance, one tip, when you're brushing your teeth, stand like a stork.
How do you stand like a stork?
I don't know. I would have gone with flamingo.
Yeah.
But maybe storks do that as well. Stand on one leg. First your left, then your right, or the other way around.
Got it. Yeah.
Minute at a time. You can improve your balance that way.
Sure.
Only thing I would add there is be careful. You've got a pointy stick-like thing in your mouth. If you were to slip and fall, could be pretty dangerous. Kind of like the same reason they tell kids not to run with a lollipop.
Yeah.
A toothbrush is kind of like that too. But yeah, nice way to work on your balance. Gabe, you've got, they're not
those
emails.
Those are emails. I got a bunch of comments that came in. You know how we somehow put our content up on YouTube? We've also recently started putting our content, but the people in the DW Science Department have put it up on TikTok.
Did you say somehow?
Yeah.
Like it accidentally happened?
I don't have firsthand experience of how this happens.
I uploaded it. That's how it happened. It didn't like...
Well, I'm speaking from my solipsistic point of view. I didn't see it happen.
From your point of view, it happened and it was on YouTube and now it's just like it's magically on TikTok. With great results, with great effect.
Especially one of the recent bits that we did on there about Peter Thiel. We spoke before our summer break about Peter Thiel and some of the comments that he made while speaking to the New York Times about Greta Thunberg being some kind of antichrist figure. We uploaded that little bit onto TikTok. These videos are very short. And people responded to that greatly. Hundreds of people wrote in, just one of them here, I can't even with this guy. And this is in reference to Peter Thiel. Another billionaire who thinks money equals being smart, in quotes. He was in the right place at the right time. He's lucky, not brilliant. I don't know what that's in reference to. All of his money, he made incredibly good investments.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
He worked hard, like a lot of people who've made money. He also works hard, but also timing, right? If you were in or around Silicon Valley at the time, let's say it's at some point in the 1990s or in and around, if you chose to move there from your previous job, which is what he did, then you were at the center of one of the biggest technological booms in human history. But the point still remains that, yeah, we discussed that similarly, that he's a billionaire influencing a lot of things, and yet he's just another person with opinions. And what's different about him is that he's using narratology. He's creating a narrative about good and evil, and to be aware that that's what he's doing, so that we can even understand his story, which probably has, you know, other underlying intentions.
That was the point of the video, that there is a science behind what he's doing, the rhetorical tricks that he's employing to get people to believe his story, his narrative. Let's move on to a study.
Yeah.
I got a real quick one, Connor.
Well, let me interrupt you.
You're going first?
Just because you were talking about TikTok.
Yeah.
And I have one. I'm just going to go through it very quickly because I do feel it's important. It's out of Australia, and some researchers took, and it's about birth control, hormonal contraceptives. Mm-hmm. And they looked at 5 hashtags to find the most popular 100 videos regarding birth control, contraception, the pill, natural birth control, and cycle tracking. Those were the hashtags. And what's out there? What are people consuming? Because these 100 videos have been viewed nearly 5 billion times. That's a lot. That's really important. What are they saying? Only 10% of those videos are from medical professionals. Most of the people who are putting them out there, they're general uploaders or quote-unquote hormonal health coaches, health educators. That's more than half the content. And I'm going to quote the paper here. Overall, the content showed poor reliability and quality, indicating a prominent presence of contraceptive health misinformation. There was a concerning trend favoring natural contraceptive methods over hormonal options. That's relevant because a lot of, even if you're out there listening to this thinking, well, my daughter or any young woman or woman in my life is not consuming this information on TikTok, those ideas spread and they kind of permeate society. They're out there. It's good to be aware of that and to know that a lot of misinformation on this specific subject is coming from that platform.
For all people listening to this, getting medical advice, especially from TikTok, be wary of that, where it's coming from.
If you're interested, anyone out there, it's in the Journal of Perspectives on Sexual and Reproductive Health. Do you know what birth control actually does to your body? Assessing contraceptive information on TikTok.
Okay, I got a real quick question. You have a boy and a girl.
Yes.
Who's more aggressive, the boy or the girl?
They would both absolutely finger the other one as the more aggressive. Physically aggressive, I think probably he is, but that I would say that's partly because he's younger and she's at this point so much bigger than him. He's 10, she's 12, and so it's kind of like feels more allowable to him to do that.
Got it. This study here is looking at the question, who is more aggressive, females or males? And there it's more complicated than you think, because outside of the house, males are way more aggressive.
No,
there are dozens and dozens of studies that have been done criminologically and sociologically that prove that males are way more aggressive, commit more violent crimes, even domestic disputes inside the house. The police come to houses because of males being more aggressive than females.
Absolutely.
But there, when it comes to inter-sibling, according to this study, females are more aggressive.
Really?
Across the whole world. They did 4,000 surveys in 24 different countries. Across the whole world, women are more aggressive than men. Girls are more aggressive than boys in childhood, but also in adulthood.
You have 3 girls, which is maybe why this piqued your interest?
Well, yesterday was...
Oh, here we go.
Hold on.
Here we go.
Yesterday was the first day of school for Lynn, 10 years old. In Germany, high school starts really early. Gymnasium starts at the age of 10. And Lynn was at her first day of school, and her sister happens to be at this school. Mm-hmm. And Lynn saw Ava at the school for the first time and ran up to her and gave her a hug. And what did Ava do? Pushed her away and said, "Hau ab," which is German for get away from me.
Get out of here.
What?
Well, I get that. I get that, though. The social costs are potentially enormous for any small behavior that isn't conformist in nature and doesn't, you know, stick to the values that your friend group represent. And so having, especially a younger sibling in this case.
You wouldn't do that to a stranger or to a normal friend, but you do it to your sister? What's going on there? And inside the house, there are too many experiences that I've had to go through watching my daughters fight. I could never, ever tell you how violent they are to each other.
Please do. We can cut the mics in just a minute here. No, I was talking to friends in the U.S. whose kids don't get physical with each other. They have three children, boy, boy, girl. And that was very surprising. I think it's very, very normal. Almost everyone I talk to otherwise says yes. Yeah, they go after it. That's what siblings do sometimes. I did that as a kid.
Yeah, everyone and when asked in these surveys, in every country except Germany, which is funny, the boys said that they weren't violent towards their siblings, both boys and girls. The girls, when asked, were more violent than the boys.
But it was reversed in Germany?
Yeah, it was just a bit reverse in Germany.
Okay. Well, that, yeah, lines up with my family a bit. Last thing here, because we're running out of time, just going to play a little audio for you.
Some kind of celebration? Of sorts?
In a way. That's the beginning of one part of a huge weekend or week of racing at Europe's premier ultra marathon race.
Oh!
Yeah, this is the UTMB.
Yeah.
Some people out there might be familiar with that. The Ultra Trail Mont Blanc. If there are two races that you want to run in your life as an ultra marathoner, this is the one in Europe.
Is this something you want to run?
No. No, too long. So that beginning there, what you heard there that's a WhatsApp video that one of my friends from the running group sent. It was two of our guys were running the 150K variant with 9,000 meters of elevation gain and drop. That's 2,800 feet. That's
running up.
That's 28,000 feet up and down.
Mountains.
In addition to the roughly 100 miles that you're running anyway.
Yeah.
Absolutely nuts. I'm going to keep this very short here and say, based on some very, very new, non-peer-reviewed research, what probably should have happened to them, all of them, as they came through the finish line at the end, like my buddy Jendrik, who raced it amazingly fast, 27 hours, they should have laid down on their stomachs and received a colonoscopy.
Why?
Because preliminary, and this is, again, very preliminary, data from a doctor named Timothy Cannon. He's an oncologist at Enova-Shar Cancer in Fairfax, Virginia. He went to the American Society of Clinical Oncology conference and talked about how basically the alarm bell for him was that three ultra runners, triathletes came in very young, very healthy. Like you couldn't be healthier. No smoking, no drinking, vegan in one case, with advanced bowel cancer. And 15% of them, so that's about one in every seven or eight, had advanced adenomas. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that word correctly, but that's the kind of polyp that is likely to become cancer. This is up to three times higher than what you would expect in the general population at that age.
It's also a reminder, regardless of how fit somebody seems, still to get checked up. It can happen to anyone, whether you're an Iron Man or an Iron Woman or an ultra marathon runner.
Cancer
can happen to everyone.
To get a little personal, maybe too personal, this was the article. Finally, I'm going back to the doctor's office tomorrow to pick up this piece of paper that I had 2 years ago and lost, which was a referral to get my first ever colonoscopy. Yeah. Have never done one. We had it in the family, and it's time for me to get one, and this is the article that will have done that for me.
There it is.
So you can hold me to account on that one sometime down the road.
Yeah, what do you guys got to say? SU at DW.com, anything, as always, let us know. What if we lived in a world where viruses had no chance against us?
Meaning they would die, right? They need.
There's no way for them to get into our bodies. We don't have to worry about viruses anymore. It's a joke when I think about a viral pandemic.
That would be great.
Impossible.
Yeah, they would still reside in all sorts of animals. Bats are known to carry lots of viruses. All sorts of animals carry viruses, but we humans would just sort of be magically immune to them. It sounds like a daydream, a fantasy, a bad plot for a novel. And according to a new paper, it might very well be possible.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dusan Bogunovic, and I am a professor of pediatric immunology at Columbia University in New York, New York, United States of America. I am here to talk to you about a universal antiviral drug we made.
And Dusan, how does somebody who's normally involved in pediatrics come up with a universal antiviral that could, I don't know, save the whole world from viruses one day? What in the world? What's going on?
I know, it's a little dreamy, right? You know, science is full of serendipity. And, you know, light bulbs going off left and right when you think you're right. Mostly you're wrong, but sometimes you're right. So I study children who are really sick and who nobody knows what to do with. You can think about it as real-life Dr. House. Just, you know, I'm not addicted to drugs or anything like that. I'm a nice person, but that's the point. So what we do is we perform genetic tests and try to figure out why a particular kid or adult, it's not just kids, but it is mostly kids, why are sick. So on that quest that I've been on now for decades, we've discovered now quite a few families that have a specific genetic defect, right? And we were like, oh, this is great. We figured out what's causing the disease they have. And there was, you know, like a mild autoinflammation that they were having. And, you know, we published that paper really well. First time in, I think, in 2012 in Science. And then in 2015 in Nature, when we figured out, you know, exactly what's going on, right? Not to go into super gory detail. And then that's where that light bulb, you know, kind of lit on a little bit. And I was like, wait, this type of inflammation that they have now, because, you know, I've been doing this work for decades and, you know, I love immunology. I'm like, this is very specific type of inflammation that fights off viral infections.
So you found out that these kids have this mysterious viral protection.
Correct.
What did you do next?
So then we were like, wow, you know, we actually published that study about 9 years ago. And I'm like, well, can we harness that and try and make a universal antiviral? And actually, just inject here, it's even better than this. It's not like you never get infected with a virus. You actually get infected with a virus, but you don't get sick, which means that you naturally turn antivirus into a vaccine strain of itself. You attenuate it. You make it much more weaker than it is.
What is the mechanism exactly? I mean, I know with the coronavirus, right? It has the key that unlocks the door, the ACE2 receptor. And then it gets in there, it hijacks the cell and uses it to replicate, at which point it goes viral. It goes exponential. At which point the process is this genetically different human being doing a better job of stopping that, and how are they doing that?
Exactly. Perfect question. So, as you mentioned, all viruses go through that process. They have different receptors, different ways they enter, different ways they hijack, you know, our own machinery for their own good. That's what they, you know, are supposed to do and evolved to do, and, you know, whatnot. So, we mapped about 60 different genetically encoded genes that are turned on in these kids, okay? And then we superimposed that on the current knowledge about what is actually being blocked against different viruses. So we know that some of them block entry, some of them block replication, some of them block translation, some of them block budding. So that's how we came up with the magic 10 number of these 60, with the idea being that if we block two or three, even one is enough, but it's always better to have two or three parts of the viral life cycle, then it's a home run.
Okay. You're taking these 10 genes out of 60 that you identified, you're switching them on to disrupt this process at various points, and then you do what? You do this with laboratory mice? Was that the next step?
Yeah, you can do it in vitro in cell lines, right? So you culture things in a dish, or you can do it in mice, or you can do it in hamsters, and we did all of it.
Give it to us. What happened?
Did it work?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I couldn't believe the results. We actually still can't find, so basically turning on these 10 genes fully replicated what these kids' cells could naturally do. Meaning, we still can't find a virus that we can find off better than without having them turned on. It's really working extremely well.
How long does it work for? Or is it one shot and you're safe from all viruses forever? Or what are we talking about here?
Yeah, I wish. No, it's here's the deal. You naturally turn on these genes when you see the virus, right? But if you're smart enough to turn them on before the virus comes, meaning, you know, my kid gets sick and I turn on these 10 genes, oh, I'll do so much better than getting sick because I am outsmarting the virus by virtue of timing. It's like, you know, being prepared for anything in life. It's better when you're prepared, right? So, and right now, there's different ways to do that. What we did in this, you know, manuscript that we published, we delivered these genes, host genes, and they're active for about 3-4 days. So the idea would be, you know, my kid gets sick or is starting to get sick. I take this drug for, you know, once and then in 4 days once again, and I don't get sick. And hopefully my kid also has much, much less severe disease than it would without the drug.
Those kids you mentioned earlier, they were suffering inflammation. They had other issues. And so I suppose my question is, if I were to take this medication, what would be the side effects of turning on these genes, even if for 3 or 4 days in advance of the viral infection itself? What would happen to me?
Nothing. And I'll explain why. Every December, January, or if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, I guess July and August, when you get flu, you get bedridden for like 5 days and you feel horrible, right? And you feel horrible because you naturally activated too late, but you did activate about 1,000 genes at about 1,000 level, right? So that's what happens to us every winter season when you have coronaviruses, flu viruses, whatever it is. I'm not even talking, you know, Ebolas and crazy things that can wipe us out, right? So that happens to us. If you take this drug, the level of inflammation that you're introducing is at a 1%. So instead of like 1,000, you're at 10. And instead of having 1,000 genes activating, you only have 10 genes. So while we haven't tested this in humans, so we'll see, I guess. But in theory, it should be much safer than you actually getting flu.
And then long term, if we imagine a world where all of us are taking these drugs, I would imagine also like penicillin and other antibiotics, which then ultimately lead to antibiotic-resistant infections. Would we then eventually probably have viruses that have learned to evade these 10 blockades?
This is a great question. Most likely not, because the first class of drugs for HIV that we had blocked only one path in the viral life cycle. And that's what happens when you have just that, then viruses mutate, right? And that's why the drugs didn't work well. The drugs started working really well when we blocked three different viral life cycle moments. So here, for some viruses, we know exactly that it's 2, 3, or plus. For some, we don't, because the science is simply not there. So it's very unlikely that the resistance would develop.
What's the timeline? When can we use this?
Oh, I want it yesterday, right? To get there, we have to do it well. It's very expensive, and we have to make sure it's 100% safe, because without it, no drug works, right? So realistically, probably 8 years at least, maybe 12. And that's if we have the backing of the government and pharma to push forward this drug.
Why wouldn't you? I mean, this sounds great. I'm trying to answer that question for myself right now. Is it because the pharmaceutical industry would see a net loss? Because an entire class of infections could potentially vanish, hence all the drugs associated with them?
It's actually a little bit more complicated than that. You know, right now, the system worldwide that we have built is a for-profit system, right? So when you develop any drug, if you come to an investor, if you're, you know, an early biotech, or if you're a mature pharma company, you have to have a business plan. So how many drugs will I sell in the next 5 years after this is approved, and will that pay off all these huge expenses to develop it? So the only way out of this business-minded conundrum is government support, where they need to make basically stockpiles against future pandemic. So really, in my mind, from, you know, what I've realized, this needs to be truly a public-private partnership. So, you know, it can be commercially viable, but if it's not in the time frame that investors need, and that is, you know, whatever, 5 years or 10 years or whatever these funds are, that it can still survive.
And if you jumped through all those hoops, what would you call your drug?
Ooh, I would call it antiviral mist.
Mist.
Yeah, because you would basically spray it into your nostrils like you do with, you know, nose drops.
And that was Dusan Begunovic speaking to us from Serbia. And we could just jump right into it. What would the world be like without the discovery of penicillin?
And yeah, and then all other kinds of antibiotics. We would be losing our siblings, our loved ones, at an enormous rate.
Our kids? Oh, it'd be, like, I would lose maybe Heidi and Lynn. Ava might get through.
Well, a cough. I mean, tuberculosis. A cough begins, and even if it wasn't that bacterial infection, you'd be terrified. Every time you heard someone cough, which is a relatively common thing, you'd wonder, is this it? Is this the one that's going to take them down? We don't have to think that way.
Because of the discovery of penicillin.
Yeah, and ultimately, since the early 1940s, we've had the ability to attack the bacteria that causes or leads to tuberculosis. It's amazing, but it's something that people who are still alive today had to grow up with. Yeah. Now we don't.
And Dusan, the guy we just heard from, believes wholeheartedly in a world where viruses don't have to happen. If his pill one day, again, it's a long, long way off, but one day that we could be in a world where, because of a pill, viruses are, they just won't happen.
Well, and that is already, I mean, you could talk about that for an hour, but you could then move to the next step where some of the nasty knock-on effects that happen from a severe or as a direct result of a severe viral infection, we were talking about this last week, that those then might not happen either. I mean, it would create all sorts of health benefits all down the line. But at the very least, it would sure make those colder winter months way more bearable for everyone. I think that's we can start there.
No more post-nasal drip.
Yeah, not with the the antiviral mist,
the mist
that Dusan was talking about there. What do you have to say about this? Surely you have something. Is it overblown? Are we getting too excited? Have we drunk the Kool-Aid too early? Let us know. We're su@dw.com.
DW, made for minds.